Support for NPR podcasts comes from HBO, presenting The Wire. The final season premieres this Sunday at 9 p.m.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Censoring Science, is largely about my guest, Dr. James Hansen, and the efforts to tone down or silence his warnings about climate change. For the past 25 years, Hansen has directed NASA's premier climate research center, the Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Hansen says the Bush administration has interfered with how scientists communicate to the public. Science has been swift-boated, is how Mark Bowen, the author of Censoring Science, puts it. Bowen is with us, too. Bowen's book reports on efforts during the Bush administration from political appointees within NASA to prevent Hansen from speaking to the press and to control statements by Hansen and other scientists about global warming and other scientific issues, including evolution. The book Censoring Science begins with a turning point, a speech Hansen made on December 6, 2005, before a meeting of the American Geophysical Union. I asked Hansen about that event. What did you say there that you think was, in a way, a tipping point to the Bush administration reaction to you?
Well, the science that I discussed was the fact that we are getting very close to a tipping point in the climate system where changes will begin to happen that are out of our control. But I think the thing that I said that perhaps caused concern was I pointed out that special interests are having a big impact on our ability to communicate this problem to the public and to find the solutions to it.
Now, what kind of warning did you receive after this speech?
Well, I was told that any future contacts with media would have to be approved by NASA headquarters, by public affairs officials, before I could speak. So if I received an email or telephone call, I had to say, I can't speak with you. You'll have to contact NASA headquarters and ask for permission to talk to me.
And you never had to do that before?
No.
Were you also told there would be dire consequences if you continued to make statements like you did at the American Geophysical Union meeting?
Well, that message was relayed to me by the public affairs official in New York City, yes.
Now, there were times when things were going on behind the scenes that I think at the time you weren't even aware of. And Mark Bowen, these are some of the things that you report on for the book Censoring Science. For example, James Hansen was invited to speak on an NPR program called On Point, hosted by Tom Ashbrook. Mark, if you could give us like a short description of what happened to that interview request.
Well, it first came in to Jim's public affairs officer in New York City, Leslie McCarthy, and she did what she was supposed to do, which was to tell everyone in the public affairs department at NASA that this request had come in. This was mostly a courtesy on her part. But then she began to get messages that the ninth floor, so-called, which is the where all the kind of senior officials of NASA reside, didn't want Jim to be on NPR. He was then told that one of the reasons was that it was the most liberal media outlet in the country. And, you know, Jim didn't actually get that message directly. He didn't even know this was all going on, as you pointed out. And it was, for a while, prevented. He wasn't allowed to speak on NPR.
Or at least on that particular show.
Yes, until he finally just decided he was going to do it anyway, which was about 6 or 8 weeks later.
James Hansen, why did you decide you were going to do it anyway?
Well, over the holidays, I thought about this restriction, and I decided I really had to make it public. I spent the holiday with my family and my grandchildren, and I decided, you know, that for their sake and just for the sake of science, that I was going to make an issue out of this. And so I wrote down what had happened in great detail over several pages and made that available to the media.
So what was the reaction you got from NASA?
Well, this did then, because it came out in the public and it was reported in the New York Times, it became a major issue in NASA, and congressman became involved and became concerned about the constraints on communication between scientists and the public, and NASA was told that it really needed to address this problem. So eventually the NASA administrator did come out with a strong statement that said scientists should be able to communicate with the public without interference by public affairs officials.
So did this make your ability to communicate with the public any more difficult or any easier when you went public?
It made it much easier in my case. However, as I pointed out in a talk shortly thereafter, this is not an isolated incident. This has become common practice, and all of the science agencies now seem to be headed by public affairs officials who are political appointees and who do attempt to influence the message that goes from the science agencies to the public.
Another example that you give of how people at NASA were edited by PR people was the case of Flint Wild, who was working on a NASA website about Einstein and referring to the Big Bang. What happened with that?
Well, there was this young political appointee who played a big role in Jim's life there for a while. He was the person who was kind of in the front line preventing the NPR interview from taking place. But earlier, he had taken an elective interest in cosmology, kind of without his boss's knowing particularly, and he had written this email to a fellow named Flint Wild who was working on a website about Albert Einstein, and I'll read the email here. It says, "Okay, Flint, we've got a slight problem here. These pieces refer to the Big Bang as if it were law. As you know, the theory that the universe was created by a Big Bang is just that, a theory. First of all, we have been given direction by our deputy AA, that is, assistant administrator, who would have been Dean Acosta, that we are never to refer to the Big Bang as anything but a theory. Secondly, it is not NASA's place, nor should it be, to make a declaration such as this about the existence of the universe that discounts intelligent design by a creator. We, as NASA, must be diligent here because this is more than a science issue. It is a religious issue. And I would hate to think that young people would only be getting one half of this debate from NASA."
Well, Mark Bowen, you write that the orders that were given from the top to people like George Deutsch, who were then expected to edit information, that these orders that came from the top were always given verbally, so that there'd be no paper trail, no email trail.
Right. Actually, Jim corrected my thinking, a certain semantic thing. It's actually orally. It was always, they were always given by mouth, mm-hmm. In person, in meetings in which there was usually only one witness at the lower level. It would be often two senior people in the presence of one career person who was directed in words to do something that this person usually had severe misgivings about. And this was very consciously done. It was a very intelligent thing. I mean, you cannot censor science in this country openly anymore, quite yet. And the people were fully aware of that. The reason that the story at NASA was harder to bring out was that they were so good at doing it. And what happened was George Deutsch, who was a young 24-year-old kid who was new here, didn't have any background in this sort of thing, made the mistake of leaving electronic, basically email records of this censorship practice.
Like the one you just read?
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guests are James Hansen, and he's the director of the NASA Institute for Space Studies. He's directed it for about 25 years, and he's been studying the human impact on Earth's climate since the 1970s. Also with us is Mark Bowen, who's written a new book about James Hansen and the censorship of science during the Bush administration. It's called Censoring Science. James Hansen, during the period that you felt you were being censored, you referred to the mission statement of your office, which included the phrase, to understand and protect our home planet. Then later you found out that that line of the mission statement was actually deleted in 2006. How did you find out, and what was behind the deletion?
Well, I began to refer to that statement shortly after my talk at AGU and the censorship issue came up because I thought it provided a very strong basis for my speaking out that, in fact, it is my job. That was the first line in the NASA mission statement, to understand and protect our home planet. And I used that in my public talks for a couple of months. And then I was informed by another NASA employee that that line was then deleted from the NASA mission statement. And contrary to the construction of that statement, which was a very public construction in which all NASA employees were encouraged to comment on the proposed mission statement, this was deleted basically in the middle of the night. Nobody knew about it except the highest level at NASA headquarters. NASA is the largest science agency, spending more resources on studying the Earth than any other agency in the world, and it made a lot of sense that we would have such a mission statement. So it's quite a disappointment to see it disappear.
James Hansen, you've said that special interest groups have had too much influence on how the United States deals with climate change. You said, quote, "It seems to me that special interests have been a roadblock wielding undue influence over policymakers." Can you give us an example where you've seen that happen?
Well, that's a hard question to answer because the way the special interests operate is to affect the media, the discussion of climate change that occurs in the public. They support the scientists that they can find, and you can always find some scientists who will disagree with a consensus view. And they make it appear that it's an even-handed issue, that some people think one thing and others think another, and so we're just not sure what's happening. But the science story has become very clear on global warming, that it is human-made and that it is growing and it's going to cause very big problems in the future if we don't begin to change our emissions. And that basically means an impact on the fossil fuel industry. And they're tremendously powerful. They affect politicians at all levels in both parties. So it becomes now really a battle, I think, between special interests and the young people who will inherit the planet and the impact of the things that we're doing to it.
James Hansen, you've said, "I believe there is pressure on scientists to be conservative." You wrote this in July in an article in The New Scientist. What do you mean by that?
Well, scientists are naturally reticent, I think. Skepticism is an essential characteristic in science. You need to continually question yourself and your conclusions and your analysis. But in this particular, in the case of global warming, we've now reached a point where if we don't take action, we're going to pass tipping points that have large consequences in coming decades and create a situation in some cases, such as ice sheet instability, that will become out of our control. So I think we need to be a little clearer with the public about the way science operates and the degree to which we can understand what is happening and what is going to happen in the future. Policymakers and the public just are not aware of the degree to which we do have a danger facing us.
And you feel that the information that global warming is really a threat to our planet is sufficient to start taking action?
Yeah, if you combine the information that we get from the history of the Earth, the paleoclimate data, which shows how the Earth has responded in the past to changes in atmospheric composition, combine that with the satellite data that shows how things are beginning to happen now in the Arctic, in the Antarctic, and combine this with global models, which are able to simulate quite well, reasonably well, what is happening, although many of the things are beginning to happen faster now in the real world than in the models. The sum of these things gives us a good picture that we do have a problem, and it is solvable, but we need to begin to take the actions to solve it.
James Hansen, what's an example of that?
Well, a good example is the Arctic sea ice, which this last summer decreased a large amount to its smallest...
20%, yeah.
Yeah, about 20%. But perhaps even more important is the ice sheets, Greenland and especially West Antarctica. We're beginning to see larger and larger areas with summer melt on these ice sheets, and the effect of that in speeding up the discharge of giant icebergs to the ocean has been quite remarkable. We still have time to avoid the disasters, in my opinion, but we're going to need to stabilize and reduce the rate of emission of especially carbon dioxide, but other greenhouse gases. And if we do that, we can stabilize the climate, but it requires actions in the near future to do that. So I think the most important thing that the public needs to do is put pressure on governments to have a moratorium on coal-fired power plants until we have the technology to capture and store the carbon dioxide.
Can I just interject here that what you said is probably exactly what makes the Bush administration most uncomfortable, that you, a scientist, are making policy recommendations that directly affect energy, coal, it would affect industry and business and so on. And I think they really want you to draw the line between just saying, this is the science.
Yeah, it's
and not crossing over and saying, this is what we should do, this is what policy should be, this is the changes we have to make. So can you just reflect on where you think the line should be, if any, you know?
Yeah, the question of the relation of science and policy is the fundamental issue. The problem is that the science inevitably has policy implications. And if we do not make clear the relation between our science and policy, it seems that no one will. And I think there's a strong analogy here to the case of NASA engineers who realize that there's a potential problem with the space shuttle, in the case of the O-rings on the space shuttle. I think when you realize there's a problem, it's your responsibility to make that problem clear to whatever levels it is necessary. And in this case, to the highest levels. And in fact, NASA engineers have been told that. They can go to the highest level if they find a problem that's going to threaten the lives of astronauts. They're allowed to go to the highest level with that information. And in this case, the highest level is the public. We need to make them aware of the implications of the actions that we're taking in emitting the greenhouse gases.
Have you ever felt that you were in danger of losing your job because of the way you've spoken out?
Yeah, I've assumed that that's a real possibility, but I would continue to do science anyhow, even if I lost the job. So it's not that big a concern of mine.
I want to thank you both for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah, thanks.
Dr. James Hansen directs NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. Mark Bowen is the author of the book, Censoring Science. We called NASA for their response to the charge that political appointees within NASA tried to alter the messages of scientists. We got this written response from NASA Administrator Michael Griffin. Quote, When these accusations were made 2 years ago, NASA put together a team of scientists, engineers, public affairs officers, and others from across the agency to examine our communications policies and procedures. That team revised and clarified those policies and procedures to ensure they clearly reflect the agency's commitment to free and open communications. The revised policy has been praised by the Government Accountability Office. The GAO report, issued in May 2007, said, GAO found that overall, NASA's policies, including its recently revised media policy, are clear and should help facilitate dissemination of scientific information. Unquote. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Paul Dano, gives an incredible performance opposite one of the greatest actors of our time, Daniel Day-Lewis, in the new film There Will Be Blood. It's directed by Paul Thomas Anderson. You may also know Dano from his performance in Little Miss Sunshine as the teenage brother who refuses to talk. In There Will Be Blood, Lewis plays Daniel Plainview, an oil man at the turn of the century. He's a savvy but not always honest salesman, persuading poor people in California to sell or lease their land to him so he can drill for oil. While he promises them prosperity, a boy preacher who has started his own church is promising to save people's souls. The preacher is played by Paul Dano. The preacher and the oil man are often at odds. In this scene, the oil man is preparing to open his new oil well. The preacher walks into the oil man's office and tries to get in on the action.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How is all the work coming?
Everything's good.
All the men are provided for.
Of course.
Spirits seem high. Is there anything that you need from me? Anything the church can do for you?
I don't believe so. No, thank you.
I understand you've asked the people to gather round and watch the well begin tomorrow. Is that right?
That's right.
I will bless the well. Before you begin, you should introduce me. You'll see me walk up towards the oil well, and when I begin,
Derek.
You'll see me walk up, and then you could say my name.
When you walk up?
Yes, you'll see me walk up, and then you could say, the proud son of these hills who tended his father's flock. And then you could say my name.
That's fine.
And what happens then?
Well, then we start the drill.
It's a simple blessing, Daniel, but an important one. It's just a few words. It won't take long. What time?
What time's good for you, Eli?
4 o'clock.
Well, let's make it 4 o'clock then. My thanks for your visit.
Good day. Thank you.
Paul Dano, welcome to Fresh Air. This is the second time you've acted opposite Daniel Day-Lewis, and he's an actor famous for the intensity he brings to researching his roles and for inhabiting his characters. Now, your character has to show such, like, great confidence in the scene we just heard. Did you have that confidence as an actor going up against Lewis in that scene?
Yeah, and I don't say that out of, you know, any sort of arrogance. Rather, I think you have to for the character. I think if you allow yourself to be intimidated or get self-conscious or look for too much approval, it's going to seep into the work. So you really you don't have a choice playing a character like this. You have to sort of go in head first and not look back.
Now, you have such a kind of quiet confidence in the scene. You're telling him kind of quietly, almost in a monotone, you know, like what he's going to do and how he's going to do it. Was that an intentional decision on your part to keep it, like, really quiet to show your power? Or to show the power you thought you had?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a charisma to Eli Sunday, the character I play, and there's a certain savviness to him. And I think his demeanor is meant to be seen as sincere as well as powerful. And I think there's a relation to Eli that I saw in the relationship a lot of people have with God, which is that you love God, but you fear God. And I think to me, to bring in my congregation and the people the way I wanted to, you have to sort of make them feel loved and appreciated and comfortable, and then you also have to be able to scare them. And I think in the sermons, you sort of get that idea where his quiet demeanor leads into something that overtakes him and is a little more forwardly and externally powerful.
Well, like there's one scene, for instance, it's kind of somewhere between a faith healing and an exorcism. You lay your hands on a sick woman and then you're throwing the devil out of her. What are you saying? Like, go out, devil? Get out, devil? What do you say?
Yeah, you know, get out of here, devil. And, you know, I suck the devil out of her hands, basically. She has arthritis. And I cast that demon out.
And you're physically doing it. I mean, you're kind of like physically throwing out this invisible devil. Who did you look at? Who did you read about or watch on TV to kind of figure out how you were going to approach that?
Well, I certainly did research for the period and did look up things about evangelical preachers. But here's the privilege I had with this character, Eli. He is a boy who did not have radio or television or internet, for that matter. He did not have a lot of books. He didn't have money to go travel around and see other preachers. Maybe a preacher came to his town or a neighboring town and he did get to go see them. But he's somebody who I think really made himself up. I think he invented himself. I think he's quite a bit of an actor. I think he created a persona at a very young age once he saw what religion and his curiosity with religion could do for him, and he was sort of savvy and charismatic and cunning enough to be able to use that, and it manifested itself into this persona that I really think he invented. So as an actor, I had this privilege to really make him up as I saw fit. I did not want to directly emulate anybody in particular, and I think Paul Anderson, who wrote the script as well as directed it. He's just as good a writer as he is a director, and his words and the language were so wonderful that a lot of it, any physicality or anything came from that. It came directly from the words, and I think channeling that was really the most important thing.
When I interviewed Paul Thomas Anderson a couple of weeks ago, I didn't know that you weren't supposed to have the role of the boy preacher, that you were originally cast as the boy preacher's brother. Mm. And this is the brother who wants to get away from the church and his family and is only in one scene very early in the film. Would you explain how you ended up playing both brothers?
Yeah, I was originally cast as a character named Paul Sunday, who is the brother to the preacher, Eli Sunday. And you know, I went down to Texas to do that part, and for one reason or another, for a reason I don't know, Paul wanted me then to actually do the Eli part, which is a really fantastic part in this film.
Just to fill in the blanks here, somebody else had been cast in that role and was replaced with you.
Yeah. And for what reason, I'm not sure, and I don't care to know or I didn't want to. You know,
that's just a
distraction.
Sure.
I remember meeting with Paul on a Thursday, I think it was, and he said, we looked at some scenes and talked about the part a little bit, and he said, I'd like you to do this part, and they'd been filming for a little bit already, so I said, oh, okay, that's great. It's a little a bit of a shock, and he said, why don't you still play the Paul part and we'll just make them twins? And I said, okay, well, this is really great. And we sort of, took a little bit of an East of Eden or Cain and Abel, idea and tried to, make that work with the twins. And then I said, okay, this is great. I really want to do it. And when do we start? And he said, on Monday. And it was Thursday. So I then underwent 3.5 days of submersion into this world and started filming 6 days a week for quite some time and came out alive, I guess.
What I love about this is that you had, like less than a week to get into character and to prepare to shoot. And Daniel Day-Lewis probably spent like a year or more like preparing
right.
for it.
I know.
So that must have been like quite a contrast.
I know. That kills me. At first, that was the first thing that probably popped into my head. And knowing how well Daniel is able to immerse himself into a world and into a character. And you certainly it's a peeve of mine when you see a period piece when you don't see the people fitting into that world. So right away, that was my first concern, was becoming acclimated to this world and to this time period before anything, setting, you know, that as sort of the groundwork, and then the biblical work and you know. I have to say there was one good thing about it, which is that I sort of didn't have time to second-guess myself or get nervous or get intimidated by anybody or anything. And I really didn't have a chance to get heady about it. I just had to use any and all of the animal and primal instincts I had for this part and just go for it without looking back. And, you know, that was a blessing in many instances, I think, because I also think that's the way that Eli largely operates, and I think that's why he gets in over his head. He is very smart, but, you know, not book smart, more this sort of street smart, and he's a bit of an animal himself. And once he's threatened by this presence of Daniel Plainview, these animal instincts sort of kick in, and he gets into sort of a battle that he's really not prepared for. So I tried to use the situation to my advantage.
But you did try to get acclimated to the period, the turn of the 20th century. What did you do to get acclimated?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, luckily they had tons of reference and research down there, and I spent, you know, time reading what I could and looking at pictures. I have to say, this guy Jack Fisk, the production designer for the film, built these beautiful sets on this ranch down in Texas, and there was nothing better than just spending time in the church and on the Sunday ranch and getting into the clothes. And it's amazing how quickly you do feel like you're actually there, because, you know, we were surrounded by these wonderful extras from Texas who were not Hollywood actors. They were people who worked the land down there and who lived down there, and they looked wonderful in these clothes. And I really fell in love with this little church I had, and just spent all my time, any research or rehearsing I did on set and where they weren't filming, and just tried to throw myself in there. And it was amazing how quickly it happened, because it felt authentic and it felt wonderful. It's really, you know, as an actor, your imagination is your key tool, but it's really a blessing when you have a reality around you like that that helps you reach that imaginatory point you want to get to.
My guest is Paul Dano. He plays the young preacher in the new film There Will Be Blood. The preacher has started a church where he claims to have a direct line to God and practices faith healing. He's at odds with the oil man, played by Daniel Day-Lewis. The oil man has been buying up all the land in the area. Without giving away too much of the story, in this scene, the preacher gets even with the oil man by making the oil man, who has no belief in God, come to the church. And at the church, the preacher confronts him.
Daniel, you've come here and you've brought good and wealth, but you have also brought your bad habits as a backslider. You've lusted after women and you have abandoned your child. Your child that you raised, you have abandoned all because he was sick and you have sinned. So say it now. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
Say it louder. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
Louder, Daniel. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
I am sorry, Lord.
I am sorry, Lord.
I want the blood.
I want the blood.
You have abandoned your child.
I've abandoned my child.
I will never backslide.
I will never backslide.
I was lost, but now I am found.
I was lost, but now I'm found.
I have abandoned my child. Say it. Say it.
I abandoned my child.
Say it louder. Say it louder.
I've abandoned my child. I've abandoned my child! I've abandoned my boy!
That was Paul Dano and Daniel Day-Lewis in a scene from There Will Be Blood. Let's get back to our interview with Paul Dano. Do you have a favorite story about making the movie?
Let me think for one sec. Oh, you know, there's two scenes in the film. There's a scene where Daniel Day-Lewis slaps me around, slaps my character around, and he drags me and puts me in the mud and shoves mud in my mouth. And then the very next day we filmed a scene where I sort of get my revenge in church, and I baptize him and I slap the devil out of him and the sin out of him. And luckily we filmed those scenes 2 days back to back, so Daniel slapped me around one day, and then the very next day I got to get my revenge. And the first take of the scene where I get to slap Daniel around, I was not supposed to actually slap him in the face because, you know, his face is going to get red and we have to do multiple takes and coverage. And it's a long scene, so, you know, it's a few minutes long at least. And I guess once we got into it, I forgot and I just slapped the hell out of his face okay. on the very first take, which was a lot of fun and very thrilling. But as soon as they yelled cut, I said to myself, oh, boy. I was not supposed to do that, and I was sort of mortified and thrilled at the same time, but I think everybody else was thrilled because the scene was going well, and we were sort of having fun and getting into it.
What about being thrown in the mud? How did that feel?
Well, the first couple takes, we actually didn't do the mud thing. That got added in, conveniently added in for the people watching and not so conveniently for me. Originally it was just some slapping around, and then we saw the mud off in the distance, and either Daniel or Paul said, well, he's got to go in the mud. And I said, okay, well, put me in the mud. And we just sort of, we did it. We did it on the last take, and then we said, well, that was really great, so let's hose him down and let's try and get another take in the mud. And then it ended up making the film. So I guess it was worth eating a little mud.
My guest is Paul Dano, and he plays a boy preacher in the new film, There Will Be Blood. Paul, a lot of people know you for your role in Little Miss Sunshine. And for our listeners who haven't seen that movie, it's about a dysfunctional family on their way to a kiddie beauty pageant that the daughter is going to compete in. And you're her older brother. And you've basically stopped talking for most of the movie because you're so angry with your family and so alienated from them. And what's it like to go through most of a movie not speaking?
It's funny. I've had numerous people say to me, oh, that must have been a lot easier to not have to talk. And it's the exact opposite. It was so much harder to have to contribute to a scene and be a part of a scene without saying anything. And it was a great challenge. And I don't even think I knew how hard it was going to be until, you know, you sort of got in the room and in front of the cameras and said, whoa, you know, we're doing an 8-page scene here and, you know, filming 5 minutes at a time, and I have to contribute to this scene without saying anything. And it was really, really a great learning experience for that reason, because a lot of acting is about listening. And I have to say I learned quite a bit doing that part.
Your ambition in this movie is to be a military test pilot, and on this road trip to kill time, your younger sister is giving you these vision tests. Mm. And it turns out that you're colorblind, and therefore yeah. you're not eligible to do what you want to do, which is become a test pilot. So when you find that out, you get hysterical, and you just start pounding the walls and the ceiling of the VW bus, and your father stops the car. You run down the side of the road screaming and weeping, and you're followed by your mother, who talks with you. She's played by Toni Collette. I want to play that scene.
Okay.
Dwayne? Dwayne, honey, I'm sorry. Dwayne, come on, we have to go.
I'm not going.
Dwayne.
I said I'm not. Okay, I don't care, I'm not getting on that bus again.
Dwayne, for better or worse, we're your family.
No, you're not my family. Okay, I don't want to be your family. I hate you. People, I hate you. Divorce, bankrupt, suicide. You losers, you losers. Okay. No, please just leave me here, Mom. Okay, please, please, please.
Terry, that was torture. Torture listening to myself like that.
Why?
Oh, it's I do not have this as a radio host listening to your own voice.
Is well, yeah,
a,
I do.
Yeah, I mean, it's like
surprise.
It's like a horrible.
I know.
It's, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I know.
But, yeah.
But you're so good at it. It's such a good performance. And I really like the way, you know, after not speaking for this whole film, basically, you just get unplugged. I mean, you just explode. And you're really, really upset, yet there's this slight comic edge to it. Mm. And that must have been a hard line to walk, to be like that angry, but to know that you're also in a comedy and there's a slight...
Right. Yeah, it certainly was. I think... The key to that, to me, the key to that film was that you sort of, if you take people to a sort of honest and real level of disappointment almost, the comedy that comes out of that is much truer and more relatable and therefore more funny, I think. And I think hopefully, you know, not laughing at always and sometimes laughing with. And I think it's a very fine line. And I think, you know, luckily the people who directed that, Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, a lot of credit goes to them because it's really tough to make a film like that work, actually, which does sort of walk that line because there is, as much of a comedy as it is, there is that under, you know, that undertow of drama, and especially in a scene like that. And, you know, I felt in good hands and lucky to have them.
My guest is Paul Dano. He plays the young preacher in the new film, There Will Be Blood. Now, you started acting on Broadway when you were 12. Do I have that right?
Yeah.
How did that happen? How did you get your first Broadway part?
You know, I always did plays all my life, but sort of as an activity. Like, I went to school. I went to normal school, and I'd go to soccer practice, and then I'd go to the local theater and do public theater for fun, you know, with other kids and with adults. And it was literally just something that I was attracted to, but not necessarily in an overly ambitious way. I was a kid, you know, who had fun doing it. And somebody saw me in a public show and asked me to, you know, do a part in a regional show, which is technically professional theater, stupid, you know, silly word, professional. But I guess, you know, you get paid for it is the difference between that and, you know, maybe public theater. And then that led to me doing a Broadway show. And it was sort of this strange little snowball effect. But, you know, I was certainly it was always important to me. I was always in school and still sort of playing sports and being a kid, you know, and doing a lot of stupid things. And I luckily also sort of got a head start on the acting career, but I don't know, even though I might have been doing some Broadway stuff when I was 12, 13, 14, I'm not sure that I saw it as a feasible thing to do as an adult, and I'm not sure. I knew I even wanted to be an actor. I think I was very keen on leaving my options open and sort of seeing what else is out there.
How active were your parents in your early career?
Well, at that age, you have to legally have somebody there to, you know, sort of take care of you. You can't just show up at the theater when you're 12 and be there for hours unsupervised. So, you know, a lot of credit sort of goes to my parents for sort of putting up with that and supporting me. And they've been pretty tremendous throughout all this. I did my first film when I was 16, and it was a film that was not the kindest subject. It was sort of it involved a pedophile. It was this film called L.I.E., and Brian Cox played this sort of pedophile, and it's a really wonderful film, actually. But they were completely open to me wanting to do this, which is, you know, sort of rare. Their encouragement has been really important. I don't think I probably give them enough credit. I hope they listen to this. I got to tell them to listen to this because they'll appreciate hearing me say that because I'm not sure I say it to them enough. But I guess they played an important part of it. But they certainly didn't encourage me not to do things, but they certainly didn't over-encourage me to do things either.
Were your parents involved in theater? What did they do professionally?
No, my dad was a businessman, and my mom worked, but once she had me and my sister, she just took care of us. And I don't know where it came from. They're both they're terrible actors, and they can't sing, and they have they really don't watch good films or anything, so I'm not sure where it came from. or even my interest. I'm not even sure where that came from. I think it was just something I was drawn to.
You had said something in an earlier interview that I really related to. You said that it was uncomfortable for you to be recognized by people because you were always afraid that you were going to disappoint them.
Did I say that?
Yeah, you
did.
That's
horrible.
Do you still feel that way?
I might have been being a little crass when I said that or kidding a little bit. I mean being, you know, recognized. It's nice that it's nice when people enjoy your work and have seen a film you're in. But it's not the most comfortable thing to be recognized. Certainly, to me, it's sort of the downfall of this job of being an actor. Is that idea being a celebrity is 100% unattractive to me. I don't consider myself one. I'm not saying I am. But the idea of possibly becoming one is really the pitfall of the job. And I think some people are attracted to that, and I can't for the life of me figure out why.
Well, Paul Dano, thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Paul Dano plays the young preacher in There Will Be Blood.